The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it's once again time for Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin, of course, is a nutritionist at the Hoffman Center. We work together on a daily basis. She is a registered dietitian. She's also earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. And welcome back, Layla. You were on vacation last week, as I was.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good. Did you have a nice vacation?
I did.
So what
was a beach bum for a week.
You were a beach bum? So what was your favorite meal during the vacation?
What's that?
What was your favorite meal during the vacation?
Dinner.
You're not going to go beyond describing what some of the sumptuous dinners were?
Well, barbecue, first of all. Barbecue.
Right.
You know, between my husband and my brother-in-law, who love to cook, my sister and I sit back and watch and have a cocktail. It's wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you did a lot of grilling. And was it grass-fed beef or grass-fed meat?
Grass-fed, and we got local lamb in Kutchog and Sangley Farms, where the arugula is always to die for, and some beautiful tomatoes and cucumbers, and just a lot of good food. A lot of good food. Yeah.
Good deal. Sounds great. So I did a lot. I did some grilling. We had some grass-fed hamburgers this weekend. And what's the source of your grass-fed beef for our listening audience?
We like U.S. Wellness meats.
Uh-huh.
For one, or wherever you find local. A lot of supermarkets now will carry grass-fed and grass-finished. You know, for instance, not just the local farmer markets here, but I find it at my local Stop and Shop. I'm also finding it at my local Key Food.
Wow. Great.
Yeah, so
okay.
It's
ever more popular. I'll give you my favorite meal for the week. I had salmon croquettes, mm-hmm. and we made it with leftover rice, white rice, and sort of stuck it together with some gluten-free breadcrumbs. Mm-hmm. And we make it with some chopped onions. And it's very good. And we saute it in some oil. It is fried, yeah, okay, admittedly, but it's delicious. And we came across these gluten-free pastas that are, we've been trying out, there's a black bean version, there's also a mung bean version, which is a pretty color of green, and we balance that out with some yellow cauliflower. You can actually see some pictures of that if you go to Facebook, on my Facebook page.
Uh-huh.
So check it out. That was a great meal, really good. So good food was had by all. So, again, on this, we're going to answer listener questions in just a moment. By the way, this is the way that you get to us to pose your question about medicine or nutrition. And the way to get in touch with us is via radioprogram@AOL.com. You can send us your questions, and we'll answer several of them in just a moment. But before we get to that, I just received my copy of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And so I have, apropos of an article they have there on breakfasts, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Me? I had a hard-boiled egg this morning and a few slices of prosciutto.
Oh, wow, great.
And a cup of green and ginger tea. That's my new thing, green and ginger tea. I'm not even having decaf coffee anymore. I'm
glad I didn't hit you off balance, with one of your Count Chocula breakfasts, with skim milk and sugar and a glass of orange juice.
It's actually a typical breakfast for me, something like that. It's a hard-boiled egg or two. It's usually one. I might have a little prosciutto, or I might even have some nitrate-free a salami or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we had any fish the night before, maybe some leftover cold salmon or cod even.
Uh-huh.
Especially if we make the cod with spinach, maybe a little bit of feta. on occasion. These are the things I eat for breakfast.
Right.
Pretty much.
So that's something that offers you sort of a high protein breakfast. And I'll share what I had for breakfast. I was in a hurry this morning because I had to get into the office early, as both of us did, and it was an early morning at the Huffman Center. And so I whipped up a couple of eggs and made an omelet, just a plain omelet with in butter. And then I had a couple of thin rice cakes with grass-fed butter. So that was, that's a sort of a quickie breakfast. And I think, that works out well. Mm-hmm. So, great. Sounds good. Sounds good all around. So there's a big article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Actually, a series of articles. They did the whole breakfast theme. And, there's a lot of myths around breakfast. There's a huge literature supporting the fact that fat people don't eat breakfast, okay? And that is irrefutable, that there actually is really a tendency for overweight people not to eat breakfast. So hence, does it follow that eating breakfast, is it a good way to help people lose weight? We've basically been telling people that, is that you should eat a hearty breakfast. And I have to say, for me personally, it's very important to eat a hearty breakfast because otherwise I'm brain dead in the morning. And, I don't function that well. Although sometimes I can exercise well into the late morning hours without eating anything. So it's kind of paradoxical for me. I don't bonk if I don't have breakfast. I can get out there and, ride 25 miles or so on an empty stomach, which is water. But so the question is, does having breakfast A, help people lose weight, and B, does it help kids function better at school? In other words, cognitively function better at school. And that's actually not just a scientific argument, it's also a political argument, because they're saying feed these kids because they're not getting breakfast at home and they have to be well fed so that they can sit there and study and absorb material. Well, sorry about that, but the series of articles in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, articles and scientific studies are not necessarily right, but they could not find a benefit of eating breakfast in terms of subsequent caloric intake during the day. Basically, people ate breakfast and then they consumed the rest of their calories through the day, or they skipped breakfast and then they made up for it in the later meals, consuming the calories they would have had at breakfast in these studies. There was a randomized controlled clinical study of the effects of eating breakfast, and it turned out that skipping breakfast does not result in a substantial increase in subsequent food intake. We think, oh boy, you're ravenous because you haven't had breakfast.
Right. Well, that depends on the person, but go on.
Yeah, it absolutely depends on the person. I mean, that's the problem with these studies. These studies, it's like the aggregate effect. It averages out. Some people do, some people don't. So the individual gets lost in the, when you look at an aggregate number of individuals. So, but they say skipping breakfast does not result in substantial increase in subsequent food intake, but rather does it decrease total daily energy consumed? It does. You if you have a 600 calorie breakfast, you will, according to these studies, you compensate. You have 600 calories less during the day. The net effect is zilch. They also did a study on the issue of cognitive performance, and what they found was that regardless of whether these kids had breakfast, they were just as dumb or just as smart. It had no impact on their cognitive performance. Now, the criticism, as you might anticipate, is that these are meta-analyses that look at a wide variety of individuals, different ages, different aptitudes, different weights, different metabolisms, and they looked at different types of breakfast, different compositions of breakfast. They didn't study, for example, the effects of these virtuous breakfasts that you and I had, because maybe breakfast for these kids that didn't make a difference was a crappy breakfast, Pop-Tarts or a high-carbohydrate cereal. So what I would like to see, I don't think this is the end of the debate about the benefits of breakfast. This may be the end of the debate about commercial breakfasts. But what they say here too is that there's a lot of skin in the game for breakfast. Breakfast is a big industry in America. They make cereals and they make all kinds of breakfast products. And the food companies are saying everybody should have breakfast. Well, yeah, that translates to profits. Also, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that said that cereal sales are going way down, and sales of higher protein breakfast foods and some of these fast food eateries that give you higher protein breakfasts, those are going up.
Those are going up, yeah.
Yep.
People are looking for more protein. Unfortunately, they're looking for it in a cereal, but the whole breakfast diet, first of all, after my years of experience, if a client or patient, anyone, including you and I, if we get two good meals a day, that's pretty good. I don't care if that's breakfast and lunch or lunch and dinner, but if one of those meals there is missing, and as long as you're satiated and happy and not going to make up for it later in the day, that's the problem. With many, I'll speak for both of us here. With many of our quite overweight patients who are not eating all day long and then having a ginormous dinner,
right,
that would consist of three or four meals, that is not the way to go. Those are the people that we encourage to eat earlier in the day,
right,
so that they get a handle on their blood sugar, so that they're not completely ravenous by the end of the day. I think that's a better way to approach it. But then we've got another bunch of patients who have not eaten breakfast in years,
yes,
who are normal weight, who are fine,
yep,
who eat lunch and dinner, and it's perfectly fine. They're not having another meal after dinner,
right,
which we would call then the third meal, wouldn't we?
Yes.
You know, it really depends on how you look at it.
Yeah, I noticed, I mean, on the weekends, I tend to go really long without having breakfast. I mean, of course, on a weekday, when I have to get to the office early, I've got to eat before I go, because I'm not going to be able to eat in the middle of the morning. So I'll have my breakfast early, right away. Mm-hmm. But on weekends, I tend to drift, and I'll try to go as long as I can. You know, so for example, well, actually, I did. I switched the order this weekend. I did have breakfast, and then I rested a little bit. Then I went swimming and bicycling. So, but sometimes I'll just get up. You know, I'll feel ambitious. 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, I'll do my exercise, and then by 11 or 11:30, I'll be ravenous and I'll have a big breakfast. But then, on those days, I generally will have two and a half meals. I'll have, you know, a big breakfast, a late lunch, and then maybe a little, you know, light snack for dinner. So, you know, hopefully it all evens out.
Right. I have found that any morning, and I tried this experiment when they talked about making the fast last longer, but on the morning end, you know, not having your first meal of the day until like afternoon, that doesn't work as well for me. And what I realize about myself is my breakfast, and I have a small breakfast because I eat and then sometime later I exercise.
Right.
Like an hour after breakfast, I'm exercising.
Right.
So my breakfast is quite early in the morning. I'm talking.
You want to get it out of the way, because then in the mid part of the day you're going to be exercising. You want to digest a little bit.
That breakfast for me turns on my motor.
Yeah.
And if I don't have it, I'm just not the same. However, I have gone the other way in skipping dinner. Sometimes on a weekend, on a Sunday or even another day during the week, if my lunch was as late as 2 o'clock. I may skip dinner that night simply because I'm not hungry for it.
Right.
And then by the time we're coming back to, you know, 15 hours later, time to break the fast for me again.
And that's to the good. You know, one thing you got to say about breakfast is that breakfast is usually taken in a sort of a virtuous spirit, in the full light of the day, in great sobriety, and people tend to eat cleaner, you know, healthier food earlier in the day, and then they put the feed bag on, you know, when the sun goes down, and yeah.
That happens too, exactly.
Yeah.
Too many, yeah.
All right. So, and, you know, I'm not going to ignore the findings in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. I'm going to take them with a grain of salt. I still will, you know, advise patients to learn their breakfast style. I think that's kind of being in tune with your circadian rhythm of eating, your optimal style. Of course, we'll take information from the glucose tolerance test that we do on the majority of our patients. If patients are very hypoglycemic, have reactive hypoglycemia, you know, we'll instruct them accordingly to have frequent small meals.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's get to our questions.
Okay. This comes from Chloe in Maui, Hawaii.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, aloha from Maui. And thank
you. We have a radio affiliate, I think, in Maui, or at least we used to. But I guess he listens to us via podcasts.
Okay. Let's see here. So Cloy says, some time back, you and Layla said you were going to talk about D-ribose. Did we say that, Dr. Hoffman?
I don't know.
He says, perhaps I missed that discussion. Mm-hmm. Could you please go over the salient points of this supplement and its benefits?
Okay. Well, D-ribose is a five-carbon sugar that is not really utilized so much in calorie burning. It's not so much a fuel sugar, although it's not so much involved in caloric storage. Mm-hmm. It is involved in calorie utilization, particularly by rapidly metabolizing cells like the muscles of the heart. Mm-hmm. So it is involved in energetics. It's also, you ever hear DNA? It's deoxyribonucleic acid. It's the building block for DNA. So ribose gets into the DNA, but also we use ribose particularly for energetic problems. And one classic example of an energy brownout in the muscles is fibromyalgia. We believe that at least part and parcel of fibromyalgia, an achy body syndrome, is faulty mitochondrial energy utilization in the muscles. So D-ribose, fairly high amounts, like a teaspoon three times daily, we use in a fibromyalgia protocol or a chronic fatigue protocol, and that really can help patients sometimes. So that's something that, you know, we want to certainly pay attention to. And
it benefits our cardiovascular patients.
And it benefits our heart patients as well, because the cardiac muscle rapidly metabolizing high energy requirements, so we use it in heart failure patients as well.
Along with CoQ10, along with carnitine, magnesium, D-ribose. Yeah,
indeed.
D-ribose.
Yeah.
Muscle recovery after exercise, it's also good for that.
Right.
We found, so, yeah. Okay, Cloy, thank you for your question.
Okay.
Do we have time for another?
Indeed, we do.
Let's go for it. Great. This comes from Deborah. Dr. Hoffman, I'm going to kind of paraphrase, I'm trying to get this down into a nutshell. I'm a 65-year-old female in good health, on no medications, I take some supplements. My D level is a 52. 2 weeks ago, saw my dermatologist, did a biopsy on a mole on my upper arm. I do have a fair complexion, but I do tan in the summer. Fast forward, I was diagnosed with melanoma. The mole was cut out with some extra for good measure, I guess, and it came back totally clear. The melanoma was basal level, she says here, and encapsulated in the mole stage one.
Okay.
Which is
stage one is, I mean, there being four stages, stage one is the best. Mm-hmm. It means that they seem to have gotten it all, and that it is relatively less likely to metastasize or spread.
Yeah. And her question is, are you going to do any shows on different skin cancers in the future? I've heard melanoma often comes out where the sun doesn't shine, like on the soles of our feet.
Yeah, that is an interesting feature of melanoma, is that it certainly can occur in areas where there's minimal exposure. You know, so I mean, if you have melanoma, in your genital area, if you have rectal melanoma, if you have melanoma on the soles of your feet, what do you say about sun exposure? It clearly isn't just about sun exposure, although we know that sun exposure increases the risk of melanoma. But that's not, clearly the whole story. What's paradoxical about melanoma is that it is associated with sun exposure, but that low levels of vitamin D encourage its occurrence and recurrence.
Yeah.
So that we do need vitamin D, which we can get from the sun. So someone who's had melanoma, I'm not sure if that is the best idea to tell them to completely shun the sun. That may not be the best way to go.
I actually heard from a patient recently who's had melanoma, said, even the dermatologist said, just come out into the sun, noon every day, about 15 to 25 minutes,
yep.
Get your sun, go back inside, and then put on your sunblock and so forth, just to be able to get some vitamin D. So,
right.
Some of them are
Yeah, I mean, maybe that is a thoughtful recommendation based on the latest findings about vitamin D, because paradoxically, ultraviolet light may be a causative factor for certain cancers, but vitamin D may have an anti-cancer effect.
Yeah.
When it comes to other skin cancers, I like the effects of antioxidants, particularly the phytonutrients. There's some evidence that things like green tea, perhaps curcumin, may have anti-cancer effects. You know, a lot of the things come from colorful fresh fruits and vegetables have anti-cancer effects too.
Yeah. All right, Deborah. You know, are you going to be talking about skin cancers in your clinical
well,
focus?
Well, yes. You know, I'm, as some of our listeners already know, I've embarked on an ambitious project, which is to do clinical focus podcasts on a variety of medical syndromes and conditions and nutritional themes. And so this week, I think we're in commemoration of the New York Times coming out in favor of legalization of marijuana.
Wow.
I'm going to talk about the health benefits or health hazards of marijuana. We're going to compare those because, you know, it's a controversial subject. And there are claims that marijuana may be very beneficial in certain ways for the health. We'll look at some of that research. But, of course, and then there are claims, oh, it's innocuous. It's much less hazardous than alcohol. And then there are other health concerns, and we'll review those thoroughly in this week's podcast.
Okay.
But we will eventually get around to a discussion of skin cancers. I think that's an important discussion. We can talk a little during that podcast about the controversy over sunscreens, because there is a great deal of controversy over sunscreens now.
There is. And you know what? A good website to go to for those listening is safecosmetics.org to make sure that you're not inadvertently getting carcinogenic or gender bender type ingredients in your sunscreen and your sunblock. So safecosmetics.org, also affiliated with environmentalworkinggroup.org, EWG.org.
Great. So I think this is a good inflection point at which we will pause, because we split our daily podcast into two parts. So let's stipulate this is part one of this week's Q&A with Layla. And when we return, we'll resume with part two and give us a preview of some of the questions that we're going to tackle in part two of this Q&A with Layla.
Part two, what is your take on Ostanol for bone health?
Okay. And anything else?
And another question is the effect of high dose niacin. How can it really damage the liver?
Okay, that's a great question, especially in light of a recent study. We'll talk about that in part two of today's Q&A with Layla. Layla, how was that for a tease? That's what we call in broadcasting a tease. Up next, hazards of niacin and... Okay. When we return, part two of today's Q&A with Layla, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.